Welcome to Parents' Perspective. I'll never play with Carmen again, stormed 10-year-old Melanie, slamming the screen door.
Oh, did you girls have another fight?
Melanie's mom looked up from the piles of laundry she was folding.
Well, it was all her fault,
Melanie began, warming to her subject. She just wouldn't do anything I told her. I told her to use the green jump rope, but no, she had to have it her way.
Well, did it really make a difference in the game? Her mom asked.
Of course, Melanie retorted, hands on her hips. With that stupid gray jump rope, nothing works. Of course, that doesn't bother her. She just does what she wants. Well, she's not the boss of me.
Sounds like you're going a little overboard on this jump rope thing, Melanie's father remarked, sitting down with a paper. Don't you think?
Fumed Melanie, stomping out of the room.
Everyone wants to boss me around. It's not fair.
From a parent's perspective, what should we know about the secure child? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. Our guest has written a book on just this subject. Dr. Stanley Greenspan, a child psychiatrist and clinical professor of psychiatry, behavioral sciences, and pediatrics at George Washington University Medical School, is world-renowned for his unique research and clinical work in child development. He's the author or editor of more than 30 books, including The Four-Thirds Solution, The Irreducible Needs of Children, The Growth of the Mind, and The Child with Special Needs. His most recent book is The Secure Child, Helping Our Children Feel Safe and Confident in a Changing World. Dr. Greenspan is married and the father of two. Welcome back to Parents' Perspective, Dr. Greenspan.
It's nice to be with you.
What are some characteristics we can observe in a child who feels secure?
Well, a child who feels secure is not necessarily what we ordinarily think of as security, a person who's impervious to being upset or who's always steady and relaxed and always thoughtful and reflective. A secure child is a child who knows how to seek help when they need it, as is a secure adult. It's the person who can talk about their feelings, but talk about it with a trusted colleague, if you're an adult with a child, either with a peer sometimes, but more often with a parent or a teacher, the ability to work with other people, because none of us can be secure just by ourselves. And it's the skills at self-awareness and self-understanding and communication that occur through relationships that actually produce a sense of security. So it's the ability to feel secure in the knowledge that you can seek help and comfort from a trusted person.
Is this the kind of thing that we program more into our daughters than we do into our sons?
People think girls, women, are more feely-touchy, you know, like to talk about feelings. But it really varies from person to person and child to child. There are little boys who are very comfortable in talking about their feelings and seeing the big picture and understanding them and seeking help when needed. And there are little girls who are very good at it. And there are little girls who have been taught that the only way to deal with feelings is to get fragmented or overly emotional and not really understand your feelings, see the big picture, achieve comfort from talking other than just getting more and more revved up and upset. And there are boys who have that same pattern too. So while as a group, if you look at thousands of girls and thousands of boys, you'll find girls talking more about emotions, but that doesn't mean that they're coping with it or understanding it better than the little boys.
How can parents tune in to infants and preschoolers to assess whether or not they're feeling secure?
Well, infants and preschoolers are actually easier than adolescents or adults because they don't disguise their feelings as much. So a secure 15-month-old toddler is a toddler who's able to take mommy by the hand, walk her to the refrigerator, point to the food that they want, and use gestures to express their desires, to express their needs. A secure 15-month-old is a 15-month-old who, when they're upset, can seek out daddy and go, and daddy's, what's the matter? And then show the toy they want up on the shelf that they can't get to and get daddy to help them. Or if they've had a scary dream that they can't even express in words, they can just go, you know, and daddy will say, something scare you, sweetheart, come, you want to sit in my lap? And they reach up and sit in daddy's lap and put their little head against his shoulder and feel better. But that's a 15-month-old, again, who can employ relationships to feel better, as opposed to another 15-month-old same set of concerns, scary nightmare, frustrated about not being able to find a toy, frustrated about not being able to get to their juice, and they just have a temper tantrum. Or they impulsively begin knocking things over or hitting another child who happens to be in the room with them, or just sulk and withdraw and become sad and sullen. So those show you the child is not feeling secure because they're not using relationships to learn to cope.
Well, if a child is behaving that way, what would we do in the...
If a child is behaving in the way where they're not showing a sense of security, well, then you go back to the drawing board, so to speak, and you say, what is it that we're not helping that child master? What abilities or capacities does our toddler need to have? Well, we need to have the ability to focus and attend, to feel comfortable and trusting in relationships, to communicate with gestures, pointing, showing, to be able to be involved in what I call a back-and-forth communication pattern where you can solve problems, what I call social problem solving, where you take mommy by the hand and walk her to the refrigerator. And if those things are not occurring, you say, what are the building blocks that I've just mentioned that are missing? Is this child not spending enough time relating to us? Are we too busy? Are we letting him watch a lot of TV? Let's get in there and get engaged so he'll want to be with us rather than withdraw when he's upset. Are we teaching him how to communicate through gesturing? Well, the only way to do that is to be down on the floor doing what I call floor time and back and forth communication. Are we doing that 3 or 4 times a day for 20 or 30 minutes? Or are we just telling him what not to do and letting him watch TV or letting him look at books but not really establishing two-way communication? So then there's another book of mine called Building Healthy Minds, which goes over 6 fundamental stages of development early in life. Also, it's a Perseus book, as is The Secure Child, and it goes through these building blocks even in more detail than in The Secure Child, where we cover these same building blocks in a broader way because we cover different ages of children from infancy up through adolescence. And it gives parents lots of examples of how to build these foundations for relating, for communicating, even without words, and later communicating with words, obviously. So we have to go back and build the building blocks when it's not present. Everyone wants a quick fix, you know, a gimmick, you know, how to turn this child into a secure little happy camper. But there are no gimmicks in life. Mm-hmm. Life is down in the trenches, building the building blocks, building those foundations, which come from intimacy and relating and communicating.
I think that's so crucial to understand that it's not something that happens instantly. You work on it.
Exactly.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to continue our discussion on The Secure Child.
Washington, D.C. with Kids, an excellent book by authors Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis, is available at all major bookstores and on the web.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We are talking with Dr. Stanley Greenspan about The Secure Child. What about grade school children? You talked about that the younger ones are easier because they don't hide their feelings. It sounds like grade school children may have a layer or two of stuff over top.
Well, grade school children can begin trying to hide their feelings because they're concerned with what their peers are going to think. They're concerned with looking, even in grade school, they're beginning to be concerned with, quote, looking cool or being just like the other guys or the other gals. And so they won't always tell you what's on their mind, but you can see it in their behavior. What you look for is any change from the expected routine you've become accustomed to in 3 broad areas. In home and family life, the child is withdrawing more, getting more tummy aches, not participating in family life as much as usual. A change in school. Grades are going down very, very quickly. Teachers are beginning to complain that little Johnny, little Susie is looking out the window, but not focusing as much as they used to. And you look for peer relationships. The child doesn't want play dates. They want to be a couch potato, you know, and sit and just watch TV after school. Or they seem to be overly anxious about a particular friend who they feel is rejecting them, but this is a change, you know, from before. So you look for changes in peer relationships, in school life, and in family life. And if you see that, you worry about some recent thing occurring in the family, in school, you know, in the child's life that might be creating that instability. But also in the grade school children, you also look for the basics. Can they use parents in a healthy, adaptive way, which means come to them with concerns, enjoy warm, nurturing interactions with different family members, siblings, as well as parents, fight with siblings once in a while, to be sure, but not all the time. Can they enjoy school, enjoy new learning? Can they enjoy their teachers? And most importantly, are they developing peer relationships? Because then during the school years, children go from the primary involvement in the family to expanding the network to include the family, but now to embrace peer relationships, what I call playground politics. But that's complicated. They have to now deal with a group, a social group, and there's a hierarchy in social groups. They may be the best at counting, but the weakest at baseball, or the best at baseball, but the weakest at counting, or the best dancer, but the weakest at telling jokes. So kids begin to get a sense of where they fit in their social hierarchy, and at times to parents it seems cruel that kids don't think of themselves as the best at everything. But children are realistic and they size things up. Doesn't mean they'll always be number three at this or number five at that, but that's where they live during these years from 6 to 10 or 12. And it's important for parents to know that and see how kids are coping with that. What do they do when Sally won't play with them? Do they go over to try to play with Johnny or Susie? Or do they say, everyone hates me? Well, if they're saying everyone hates me, they're not learning to cope with the intricacies of playground politics.
And so how do we as parents intervene if we sense some insecurity in our grade school kids?
Well, again, what's the missing piece? Are they using what I call polarized thinking, all or nothing thinking, everyone hates me, or everyone loves me, versus what I call, the technical term is gray area differentiated thinking, but for general use, we can just say gray area thinking, which means shades of gray. Gee, sometimes kids like me, sometimes they don't like me, or little Sally likes me as her first best friend today, but tomorrow, if someone else has a better computer game, I may be her second best friend. So kids are learning gray area thinking, but if they're not mastering gray area thinking, learning that feelings are relative, a little more, a little less, and operate in the all or nothing, then they're not mastering a lesson of the grade school years that they need to master in order to be not just healthy in terms of their peer relationships, but also good students, because they got to learn that there are different reasons for the Civil War, and some are more important and some are less important. So they have to learn gray area thinking in a number of ways. So if they're not learning that, what's missing? In our families, do we deal with feelings in an all or nothing way? Or do we look at shades of gray? Do we have a tantrum? Do we get angry at our children? You know, and are we overly firm? That may look good on paper, but it's not teaching gray area thinking. It's teaching all or nothing thinking. Do things my way or the highway. That teaches boom, 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 rather than shades of gray. So are we helping our grade school children learn gray area thinking? Are we helping them get to the point where they learn to do what I call think off an internal standard, where they can say things by age 10, 11, or 12, gee, I'm angrier than I should be given what just happened, where they can actually evaluate their own responses? This also helps them in schoolwork, where they can evaluate an author, saying, gee, I don't like this author's story that much because I would have this child respond differently to his father when his father upset him. But that ability to think off an internal standard is the basis for judgment. It's beginning to happen at ages 10 or 12. Are we helping our children learn that? Well, to do that, you've got to have lots of discussions in the family where you're interested in the child's opinion. Mm-hmm. What do you think? And why do you think that? But if we don't do that kind of interaction with our children, we're not going to promote that sort of thinking.
A teacher once told me when my now 33-year-old was in nursery school, make sure your children understand when you make mistakes or when you're unsure of yourself. Say so. Say, oh, no, I burned the toast again, or whatever it is, because then you're modeling what you want the child to express.
Right. Well, that's helpful. So the child sees you're human, that you have a range of feelings, that you, too, can make mistakes. And we always help our children when we tell them little stories, you know, about our own childhood where we struggled with things. But, again, I want to emphasize that doesn't replace these long discussions where the child is doing the thinking. See, modeling doesn't teach a child to think. Modeling just gives them an example of how an adult might think or how you may have thought as a child that may inspire them, but it doesn't teach them how to do it. To teach them how to do it, you've got to engage with them and help them express their opinions about things. How do they feel when they goofed up on that math test? And how do they think their teacher felt? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm, how would they guess you felt when you were a child? Can they put themselves in your shoes, knowing you? Well, Mommy, knowing you, you probably threw a real fit, you know, but whatever it is. But that's what helps children learn to extend themselves and think.
What might be some red flags that adolescents would send up if they're feeling insecure? This is the toughest, I think.
Well, the adolescents are, again, tough because they can disguise and there's so much going on during adolescence. But at the same time, it can be very, very clear that if you keep your eye on the basic principles, again, know your teenager, be part of their lives, be involved. And that's true of any ages. And know their baseline. What is their routines? Who are their friends? What's their routine at school? What's their routine in family life? Again, first question is any changes? Pulling away from family life, shifting their peer group to a new group that you don't know about, or no friends at all, or withdrawing into secrecy. Schoolwork suffering, starting to get bad grades, not paying attention, getting negative school reports, not handing in their work when they did hand in the work as opposed to a child who never handed in their work. So changes in school. First question, home or peer relationships. Second group of questions, are they mastering the stages of adolescence? Just like we wanted our toddler to be a social problem solver, we wanted our school-age child to be a gray area thinker. In adolescence, are we getting signs, in spite of the chaos of adolescence, of greater reflective thinking, of expanding social horizons, of expanding awareness? For example, are relationships becoming more intimate and more meaningful so that there's a real peer group, close relationships, you know, a best friend or best buddy, interest in more romantic entanglements as adolescence proceeds up into middle adolescence and late adolescence? Are we seeing interest in those areas? Are we seeing greater involvement in schoolwork, an interest in math or science or an interest in English or literature? Is something turning the child on academically? Are they, while pushing the parents away and wanting more independence and keeping the parents out of their private lives, are they also relating to parents at the same time in a more mature way, earning respect, you know, as opposed to just pushing you away? So a child can push you away, not reveal a lot about who he has a crush on or who she has a crush on these days, but at the same time participate in family discussions about politics and other events in a way that you say, gee, what a thoughtful young gal or thoughtful young man. So you're looking for the increased closeness and increased mutual respect at the same time that you're respecting some of the boundaries. But to have that, you've got to be part of your teenager's life. And most importantly, you want to see in all these areas, peer relationships, schoolwork, family life, this ability to think off an internal standard, the ability to evaluate your own behavior and feelings in spite of the tumultuous nature of adolescence. So where the adolescent can say, gee, I really overreacted in that situation. Or, mom, you know, I think you're mistaken here, in arguing their point of view as opposed to just storming off. And obviously, when you're not seeing mastery of these kinds of things that I'm talking about, reflective thinking, better ability to evaluate your own behavior and feelings, and you're seeing changes in these three core areas of peer relationships and family life and academics, and if at the same time there's some super red flares going up, signs of drinking behavior, signs of drug use, the signs of self-destructive behavior, signs of increased secrecy, signs of withdrawal into computer games too much, or withdrawal into a private life, or just isolation and loneliness, or more signs of despondency and sadness. Those are, the symptomatic red flags, but they are only present because these other red flags are there and maybe you hadn't noticed them, that the child wasn't mastering the age-expected capacities and was showing changes in their core areas of functioning.
Are those symptoms that should take you to look for a professional for help?
Well, what you first do always when you have concerns about your teenager, again, we're talking about three levels of concerns, change in basic patterns, not mastering the stages and tasks of adolescence for reflective thinking, and then the symptomatic red flags. So we're seeing three levels of red flags. And when you see any of these, the first thing is what's going on here? And reevaluate the family. Are we a part of our teenager's life? Do we know what's going on? And that doesn't mean intruding or cross-examining or becoming like the FBI. That means establishing a daily presence in your lives, one that's mutually respectful and fun. Can we do hobbies with them? Can we join them in their music? You know, can we chit-chat while we're driving them to a friend's house? So find out what's going on. As you find out what's going on, you'll be better able to assess whether you need professional help. Sometimes you're seeing the beginning of some red flags, but you reevaluate family life and you realize that you've been on the go, that daddy's been traveling a lot at work, mommy's been unhappy because daddy's been away. or there's a single parent who's been unhappy because of things going on in their lives, and the child has been spinning off on their own. So you reestablish the connection. You get involved in the child's life, and all of a sudden, grades start picking up again. Schoolwork is going better. There's more involvement in the family. Peer relationships start appearing again, and the child starts looking happier. You say, gee, well, maybe we prevented the child from developing, and you're getting a sense of their lives and a sense that they were a little unhappy and going through some tough times, but now they're regrouping. On the other hand, you get involved and you see, gee, my child is really having trouble in school. Maybe there's some processing problems that are finally surfacing that maybe we suspected when they were little but weren't sure about. But now that the work is getting harder, he maybe may need some tutoring help. Or maybe there's some psychological issues. Maybe there's some things that are hard to cope with. My child is so sensitive to the slightest sign of rejection by peers that just the expectable, ordinary peer relationships are throwing, you know, Johnny or Sally for a loop. And maybe they really need to talk to someone because I'm only able to go so far in helping them. So reestablish those family patterns that are helpful and then assess. And then if you need professional assistance, by all means, seek it out. But always reestablish and work as a family together with seeking professional help or first. Obviously, something acute is going on that you're worried about, drugs or drinking or severe depression, you know, seek help immediately.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to finish our discussion on the secure child.
For an audio cassette copy of Any Parent's Perspective show, send a check or money order for $5 with your name, address, and phone number to Parents Perspective, P.O. Box 42283, Washington, D.C., 20015.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We're talking with Dr. Stanley Greenspan about the secure child.
What about what's happening in the outside world these days? There's so many things that kids are exposed to in the media, from September 11th to movies that throw different ethnic groups in a bad light and so forth. How do we deal with kids who are feeling insecure from those kinds of things?
Well, unfortunately, we live in a changing world with a lot of scary things happening. 9/11 was the sort of symbol of all the scary things that are happening. And it's not as though scary things haven't happened before in history. When I was little, I remember we were hiding under the desks, mm-hmm. you know, practicing in terms of bombing raids, etc. But it's even more ominous now, I think, because of weapons of mass destruction being in the hands of so many people, and teenagers especially, but even grade school children are aware of this. And the grade school kids can't assess the probabilities. The teenagers are a little better at assessing the probabilities. So in some sense, they may be less scared, but the fact that they can see the future, they realize, as we all do as adults, that this is going to get worse. More and more groups are going to have access to huge biological and other weapon systems that are going to make life even more hazardous in the future. And then there are the daily events in the media, or a new movie coming out, or a new TV show that's scary, or just the news itself being very, very scary. So here's what I recommend, that parents need to realize that security starts at home in the little micro environment that you've created for your child. That's your little oasis. That's your security nest. And in your security nest, you need to always have a baseline of warm, nurturing interactions. For the children, it's called floor time. For the older kids, it's hangout time. But do that every day, so that connectedness. That's what enables people to feel secure even when life is scary. And number two, create times where you can talk about what's cooking, what's going on, but only against the background of having these nurturing interactions where you're all working together as a family, where you're taking an interest in your child's interests, beating to their drummer, so to speak. Then other times, whether it's during dinner or other times, talk about what's going on in the media, a new movie, a new book, the latest report on terrorism, and get your child's take on it. How are they feeling about it? And just the sharing of it is very, very helpful. And then the third step, what can we do of a practical nature? Turn passivity and helplessness into activity. Something as simple with a preschooler making cards for families that were affected by 9/11, or in some when there was a sniper here in the Washington area, you know, sending cards for the families affected by the sniper. Something practical, something active. For teenagers, it might be brainstorming at school with friends about what the long-term solutions are. to this type of chaos, to this type of fear? What kind of political changes do we need worldwide?
Which is nice, I would guess, for adolescents because it takes the immediacy of the worry out of the picture and puts it into a more long-term kind of situation that they could actually work toward.
Exactly. So what would they do if they were president or vice president? And this should be going on in schools, too, because no one has good answers right now. And we need our teenagers thinking about it because they're going to be the adults soon and begin running the world. So we need to embrace. And school-age children can do different projects, from raising funds for families in need around the world to brainstorming how to help other children who are more worried than they are feel secure. There's lots we can do that are practical. So turn passivity into activity, come up with some practical steps. And as part of that, also educate children. Family members should be doing this and educators at the things they need to be aware of, just like parents do about not going into the car of a stranger, accepting food from a stranger. Similarly here, you know, practical things, if there's a terrorism alert, you know, what to do if, you know, you're at school and something happens. So the child knows, I go to my teacher or I call home. There's a series of steps. My feeling is a game plan makes people feel secure, that you have some idea of what to do. And parents will then impart that to the children. I would say in the short run, parents need to get up and organize these groups around school districts using local PTAs and other organizations, and then putting pressure on their local and state and national governments to help them out.
All our listeners out there, you've got your marching orders. We don't want to leave this program without leaving all of our listeners with some resources that might be of help in this time of insecurity for children and adults. So what kinds of things would you recommend?
In terms of the books that I've had the honor of working on, The Secure Child is a good book to start with. And then for young children, I would read Building Healthy Minds for Children 0 to 5. For children between ages 5 and 12, I would read Playground Politics, The Emotional Life of the School-Age Child. And for the adolescent, I would read The Secure Child, because we have a good section there on adolescence. And The Secure Child is a good one for all ages. Also, I have a new web-based radio show focusing on children with special needs, learning disabilities, learning differences, emotional and behavioral challenges, as well as typical developmental patterns and special strengths. It's available all the time. Once we have the show, it's archived. And you can tune in that evening or next week or 6 months from now, and all the shows will be available on web.
Okay, you need to get to it.
Okay, and it's www.floortime.org. We have a new foundation called the Floor Time Foundation. So it's www.floortime.org.
This sounds like this will be a very welcome resource for parents.
Well, thank you.
That's terrific. Thank you. Well, speaking of thank yous, thank you very much, Dr. Stanley Greenspan, for being with us today and enlightening us once again on a very, very important topic for parents, and that is how to help our children feel secure.
Well, thank you for having me.
Our gift for our first caller is an autographed copy of Dr. Greenspan's latest book, The Secure Child. Just call us toll-free at 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. That's 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address and mention show number 215. Tell us, if you can, what station you're listening to. Since we're airing all over the world, it's always fun to know what station you're tuning into. Dr. Greenspan's book and all of his books are available at all major bookstores and on the web.
To learn more about Parents' Perspective and our latest book, Washington, D.C. with Kids, visit our website, http://i.am/parentsperspective. That's http://i.am/parentsperspective. This is Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis. We're glad you could share Parents' Perspective. Our sound engineer is Damon Fisher. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.